/walk.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. CMPD Officer Randall Carrick's trial ended Friday afternoon with the jury telling the court they were unable to reach a decision on the charge of voluntary manslaughter in the shooting of Jonathan Ferrell. Based on four deadlocked votes, 7-5, 8-4, 8-4, and 8-4, and word from the jury that the impasse was unlikely to change, Judge Robert Irvin declared a mistrial.
It appears the court, based on the responses of the foreperson and the main jurors, that there's no reasonable probability of a jury agreement on a verdict. In this case, the court would declare a mistrial. In case will remain open for further proceedings.
Although the defense asked the judge to declare that mistrial, the prosecution requested that the court ask the jury which way the vote was leaning. It turns out eight of the jurors had voted for acquittal, while four wanted to convict Carrick. Almost immediately after the mistrial was declared, protests broke out downtown and continued into Saturday, but for the most part, those protests were nonviolent. This hour, we hear from reporters who were in the courtroom for the trial and from a legal analyst about the evidence presented and what factors might have led to that hung jury. And we get a recap of the events this weekend that followed the decision, as well as what might happen next in the case. WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn covered the trial for WFAE News, along with our Duncan McFadden. They're both with us in our Spirit Square studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Eric Frazier is an editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, who has written extensively about the trial. He joins us as well. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Scott Royal returns. He is a Charlotte School of Law criminal law professor and former U.S. attorney. He was in the courtroom for the closing arguments and closely followed the trial as it proceeded. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
Prior to the start of the trial, did anyone see a mistrial as a possible outcome? Eric, go ahead.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, when you have a community as divided as the community was over, you know, the perceptions of what had happened, if you have a jury that's representative of that community, it kind of stands to reason that they may be divided too.
Scott?
Well, I agree with Eric, and in fact, I spoke on Duncan's show last Wednesday and said I thought it was going to be a hung jury. So for the reasons Eric spoke about, I think that's right.
And during the trial, several analysts said it looked increasingly like a hung jury was going to be the end result of this. Why? What was happening during the trial or during deliberations that led people to believe that before the outcome actually became apparent? Okay. Nobody knows
the answer to that question. I don't think anybody was surprised by it, because throughout, in talking with people in the hallways and talking with people in the courtroom, everybody seemed to have thought this was going to be a hung jury, and a lot of people said they didn't think that the prosecution had done a strong case.
So after the mistrial was declared, Jonathan Ferrell's mother, Georgia, reacted to it with disappointment.
I felt that I got to keep fighting. We must get justice. Jonathan was an innocent bystander looking for help and killed. So we got to stop them from killing our children.
The family's attorney, Christopher Chestnut, called out the defense for playing the race card. Chestnut characterized Ferrell as all-American and said the defense tried to portray him as a black thug. And he also called for a new trial.
Today's outcome was not what we had hoped for. It's not what we expected, but it wasn't an acquittal either. And so we're standing here today in solidarity, asking, expecting, praying, and hoping that justice will befall Jonathan Ferrell, that there will be another trial.
So given the deadlock, which was 7-5, 8-4, 8-4, 8-4, is there likely, and the fact that I think we have polled the jury to a certain extent, and they were leaning in toward acquittal, will there be another trial? Will the prosecution want to handle this again?
Unlikely, Mike. Even if it had been 4-4 acquittal and 8 for guilty, I think there's still a very steep hill for the prosecution to retry this. The fact that it was 8 for acquittal, I cannot imagine that they would seek a retrial. In my 9 years at the U.S. Attorney's Office, we never would have done that. But there may be other factors at play here that we don't know about.
Immediately after the conclusion of the trial, there were some minor protests downtown. I believe it started outside of the courthouse, eventually made its way to the transportation center, which they shut down, then to the Knights ballpark where a game was underway. And then the following day, there were some protesters out in front of the Panthers game. How many arrests were made? Not many.
Not many, yeah. I think the police did a really good job of presenting, you know, sort of a strong front, but retreating when, you know, strategically in order to not inflame things. I think some other police departments around the country could have, you know, they could have used that template in previous situations.
How much of the lack of a problem with protests after this trial was due to that versus the fact that it was, in fact, a mistrial and not a verdict of not guilty? How much of it was due to that? How much of it was due to the fact that prior to the trial and during the trial, a lot of African-American churches and leaders were really trying to tamp down what might happen in the wake of this trial?
Sure. I think all of that played a role. But you also had a situation where this was a police department that brought the charge against one of its own. And people in the African-American community have been following the case closely, and they, you know, they give the police department credit for, from their perspective, trying to do the right thing. And so you don't start with a totally antagonistic situation between the black community and the police department, because the department was seen as trying to do the right thing.
Duncan?
And it's probably fair to point out that both the police chief at the time this happened, Rodney Monroe, and the current chief, Kerr Putney, are both African American.
And I'd like to also point out, too, that right after the verdict, the protesters, they were not trying to be in the face of the police officers. The police had their bicycles lined up, but they stayed in the streets, and they were, you could tell that they were not happy and angry, but I didn't see any just right in the face of the police trying to start something and get something going between those two factions.
Scott?
Well, in addition to what the folks have said, I think that it was pretty clear throughout, and the evidence supported, that there was no race factor here. The jurors all came immediately when they went back to deliberate, all agreed that race wasn't a factor and they weren't going to consider it. So whatever was at play here, race did not.
Why did they decide that race was not a factor, given the fact that there were three police officers on the scene? Two were black, one was white. One black officer didn't pull a weapon at all. One black officer pulled and fired a taser, and the white officer fired his gun. Why was race not a factor?
Well, I think with regard to your accurate comment about the fact that Carrick was the only one that pulled a firearm, there was evidence submitted at trial that Carrick's supervisor had reprimanded Carrick in the past for not pulling his firearm when the other officer had already pulled a taser. So he was in fact doing what he had been told to do.
Trial Judge Robert Irvin said at some point that in his experience, Mecklenburg County trials end in more mistrials than in other parts of the state. Why would that be?
More diverse jury pool, people from different backgrounds who are going to see things differently. Other parts, maybe rural parts of the state, are more homogenous, and you get more unanimity more easily.
Now, The Observer and a few other media outlets have heard from a few of the jurors since the trial ended, Eric, and The Observer's front page headline yesterday was, "Jurors agreed race wasn't at issue in the Carrick trial." And that's based on conversations with several jurors? How many jurors did you talk to?
I think we talked to three. I didn't personally, but we talked to three.
Is it unusual not to be able to talk to all of them, or did you try to talk to all of them?
That's pretty usual, yeah. Jurors in cases like these a lot of times don't want to, that media spotlight is extremely loud and harsh, and these are just regular people, and they kind of tend to run away from it.
And we know that it leaned toward acquittal, 8-4. Do we know who comprised those eight people and who comprised the four?
I believe the jury included seven white people, four of them were women. Of those, well, let's break it down that way first. Then three African-Americans, two of those were women, and then two Latina, both of them were women. I believe one of the Latina women was for not guilty. One of the African-American women was for not guilty. And then
Six
of the white jurors. That's a lot of math to do in your head at this hour, Mike.
I understand. So they deliberated for several days, the jury did, and they asked the judge for several key pieces of information through the trial or through the deliberation period. What did they ask for, and what did that tell you, for instance, Scott, as they were asking for pieces of evidence and rules on certain laws?
Right. The jurors generally want clarification on the charge so they can think through the reasonable doubt and how it applies to the elements of the count. They ask for a lot of things such as diagrams, testimony, which showed me that they were very conscientious in thinking through guilt or innocence and really focusing on that question, that basic question. When Farrell ran towards Officer Carrick, did Carrick act responsibly? Did he have options, or was it a situation where he's being run at, he told him to get down three times and he really had no other reasonable choice, or didn't he?
They showed that dash cam video, the only dash cam video that existed, in the trial several times, and then the jury, I believe, asked to see that video again, and they viewed it in the jury room several times, and some see that as evidence that they might have been having a very difficult time in determining what the real situation was. Is that how you see it as well?
I do. I think we've all probably seen it a number of times, and it's ambiguous at best. It shows Mr. Farrell turning and quickly moving towards, mm-hmm. what they call it, running towards Officer Carrick, but nobody sees what happens after that, and that's really the crux of the case.
Yeah.
You see that, Eric?
Yeah, I think I've always thought that if you could see the moment of impact, the moment of collision between those two men, it would have been a much more clear-cut situation, because then you could tell if Jonathan Farrell was just running and, whoa, there's a police officer and he happens to collide with him, or if, as the defense contended, he was aggressively going at that officer, you would know one way or the other.
You just put your hands up as you went, there's a police officer, and he did not put his hands up as he ran toward.
But we don't know that.
Well, at least
in the part of the video
people who testified, one of the officers who was on the scene, said that happened when the dots appeared on his shirt, mm-hmm. from that taser aimed at him. And so that after that, as you said, we don't know what happened after that, because the other officers did not have their dash cams on.
Mm-hmm. Well, the bottom line is it's so short, and it records the portion of it, of the incident. It is such a small portion of what happened. You can really take the testimony of the people who were there and interpret it whichever way, I guess, you were leaning before, and that may be one of the reasons. This is the mm-hmm. key piece of evidence, and it just wasn't conclusive.
Did the other two officers corroborate Randall Carrick's version of the story?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say there were some things that they did. Say, for instance, Officer Neal, who was on the scene, and he said that he didn't hear commands given. He said he didn't see whether or not he couldn't see Jonathan Farrell hitting, Officer Carrick. So those parts he didn't kind of go along with some of the testimony. But as he also mentioned, he wasn't as close mm-hmm. as Officer Little, who was close. Now, Officer Little did back up a lot of what Carrick said. But one thing, when you were asking things they asked for, they also asked for those interviews that were done right after the shooting, and that seemed like they wanted to see, are we having a discrepancy in what you said right after the shooting and what you're saying now?
And there were some discrepancies in the testimony compared with those interviews.
Duncan McFadden and Gwendolyn Glenn, both reporters for WFAE, who covered the trial at length for our news department. Also with us, Scott Broyles, criminal law professor from the Charlotte School of Law and former assistant U.S. attorney, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Main Street Books Davidson, feeding the imaginations of readers since 1987. Presenting author Matt Neal Null, signing his book, Honey from the Lion, September 17th. Details at MainStreetBooksDavidson.com. One of the hottest tickets on Broadway right now is a show directed by York County native Charles Randolph Wright. That show is Motown the Musical, and it opens for a week-long run here in Charlotte tomorrow night. And Charles Randolph Wright will join us tomorrow morning to talk about his journey from South Carolina to the Great White Way with many stops in between. And we talk about how he got Motown's Berry Gordy to let him direct this show in the first place. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, about 60,000 women a year are diagnosed with an early-stage breast cancer known as DCIS. A new study revives the debate over whether to treat it, as most women now do. The latest on the new findings and what they mean.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're recapping the Randall Carrick trial, which ended on Friday afternoon in a mistrial. The jury deadlocked, finally 8-4. Gwendolyn Glenn and Duncan McFadden covered the trial for WFAE News. They're here in our Spirit Square studio, along with Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Scott Broyles, a criminal law professor at the Charlotte School of Law. The incident occurred on September 14th, 2013, and just hours after that, then-Police Chief Rodney Monroe decided to charge Carrick with manslaughter. It seems quick. Was it, and why? Why was the decision made so quickly?
As a former prosecutor, I'd say it was quite quick. And I've talked to a number of people, both in the legal field and some folks in law enforcement, who were surprised how quickly the charges were brought, because there was so much evidence to sift through, and it seemed that they didn't complete that process.
And in fact, initially, CMPD told the public that Officer Carrick's actions were appropriate and lawful, but they quickly changed that stance. And Tony Scheer, a defense attorney and former assistant district attorney, said that surprised him.
This case started out really unusually, where an officer shot somebody, and the district attorney's office and the police department made a very quick decision to charge him. The mere fact of deciding to charge Officer Carrick several weeks later after a full investigation would have been unusual in itself. Deciding to charge him within the same day that the incident took place was a very, very quick decision.
Plus, the first grand jury to hear the case in January of 2014 declined to indict him. A second grand jury did, in fact, indict him for voluntary manslaughter. How did the second grand jury get the case, and is that unusual? If you're if the first one says no, why take it to a second one? How unusual is that?
It is unusual. The old saying, we've all heard, grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. And so, and it's an easy, easy hurdle to get a grand jury to return a bill. And the fact that the first one did not, in my experience, that would have been really the end of the case.
Well, there seems to be an eagerness to charge him and bring it to trial. Is that because they didn't want to have a Ferguson on their hands? Is that why?
That has been...
Because it predates Ferguson.
Yeah, that has been a lot of the speculation in the community. Even though it predates Ferguson, you still had a lot of, you know, this sort of tension going on. And as you know, Charlotte has a long history of, police shootings of unarmed black... well, in the 90s, there was this whole spate of them. So that has been something that people speculate about.
And I was going to ask you too, Scott, one thing that, because I asked people that question as well, and they said that first grand jury was not a full grand jury, and that was one reason why they went for a second one. Is that something that plays in the legal?
I just wasn't aware of that, Gwendolyn, and can't comment on that.
It took just under 2 years to bring this case to trial, and the trial began, I think, Monday, August the 3rd. Farrell's mother had earlier complained about the time it had taken to bring Randall Carrick to trial.
No parent, after you bury your child, which we don't supposed to, should have to wait almost 2 years for a trial for an innocent person. If he had been an animal they killed, they would already had put that person in jail. But my child is a human, and because he's a young black man, his life, they don't think his life worth an animal, more than an animal. He has a soul. He has family. He have a sister. He have brothers.
The Constitution guarantees you a right to a speedy trial. This took just under 2 years. Is that longer than average for a case like this to come to court?
Well, I'm not as familiar with the state as the federal system, but no, there's backlogs that go on. There's Speedy Trial Act, but there are reasons that they get pushed back, and it's usually nothing nefarious.
And we know that if this gets put back on the calendar, if the prosecution decides to try this again, it will be another year before it gets onto the court calendar again, correct? Probably.
We'll have to see.
What have we come to learn about Jonathan Ferrell prior to September the 14th in the course of this trial? What do we know about him? What kind of a person?
Well, he was in one of your clips earlier. I think his mother or someone described him as an all-American type kid. And to a large extent, that seems accurate. I mean, he wasn't... Well, I think there was this portrayal, and one of the jurors, I guess the lone African American male juror, took issue with the fact that he felt that the defense tried to portray him as a violent thug type guy, which was not. That's totally out of character.
And when you say he's all American, he was a football player,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he had moved to Charlotte to be with his girlfriend. What happened that night that led to this incident?
Well, he had gone out with some friends and maybe had a couple of beers, I think it was. And
well, that's what they said. That and he, they had other people he worked with. He was working two jobs, trying to get back into college, according to his fiance. Mm-hmm. And that particular night, he went out with friends, and those who worked with him at a local retailer said he normally didn't go out, and he went out with them that night. Some said they saw him have one beer. He might have had two. They weren't sure. And that they were just having a nice time. He gave a friend a ride home, and it was after he was leaving the friend's house that he had the accident.
Yeah, and if I understand this correctly, they obviously did a blood toxicology test, and his alcohol blood level was below the legal limit, so he could still drive. It was alleged at some point that he had shared some marijuana in the garage of the friend he took home, and they did in fact find his DNA on the roach, but no evidence of marijuana in his bloodstream. So we don't know what led to the accident, do we? We have no idea how that car found itself in an accident.
According to the testimony from the experts, they did not. They said may have been distracted, but they said there were no tire tracks showing that, you know, he braked suddenly, right, and he probably was looking down or something, they speculate, and then just ran off the road because it was a dark road. It was two-lane and very heavily wooded area. So it just veered off to the right into the woods and ended up wedged between trees, and it was really mangled.
Yeah, there was one other fact that was brought out, that he was apparently going 38 to 50 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour speed zone area.
According to The Nation, Ferrell's car wreck was, this is a quote, was so awful that Ferrell, according to police reports, had to climb out of his back window. He somehow stumbled in the middle of the night to the closest home and pounded on the door begging for help. And then they quote Charlotte Police Chief Rodney Monroe is saying he was banging on the door viciously. Those are Rodney Monroe's words. During the trial, prosecutors played the 911 call placed by the homeowner on whose door he was knocking.
There's a guy breaking in my front door.
There's a guy breaking in your front door?
Yeah, he's trying to kick it down.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, do you know this person?
Yes, he's a black man. I opened the door and thought it was my husband. I just woke up out of some sleep.
Okay, all right. What's your name?
Sarah.
Okay, Sarah. You said he's a black male?
Yeah.
Okay.
In addition to calling 911, the home security system was also triggered. Did the homeowner trigger it, or was it set off by something else? Do we know the answer to that question?
I don't know. You know, I don't think that was specifically brought up.
Mm. Well, here's that audio.
Safety, security, identify yourself.
Please help. Please help.
Ma'am, is everything okay there?
No! Please send the police. I'm on the phone with 911.
So how did the prosecution characterize those two conversations and what we heard in the background, particularly of the CPI recording? How did they characterize that during the trial?
Well, the prosecution said that he was that was the only house that was nearby, and they said that he was not viciously banging on her door, that she had a motion light outside, and they portrayed it, if you are a burglar, you don't normally knock on somebody's door and you don't stand in the light where everybody can see you, and that probably he was distraught from that accident, and that's when they showed a lot of the pictures of the car. And they said that in terms of, the defense said there were some dents on the door, and they said that those were just some small dents, and that there was blood also on the screen door and where possibly he had some scratches on his mm-hmm. forehead and arms, and that he was a person seeking help. And
do we know what he was saying? That's fairly relatively I've listened to that cut 1,000 times, and it's unintelligible.
Yeah, can't make it out, yeah.
Between the time of the 911 call and the alerting of the security company, what did Farrell do? Where did he go until the police arrived? And how long was that interval? Does anybody know?
I don't know the length of time, but he went – Pool House Road is right down from – he left the homeowners after she, of course, did not let him in. They said he walked out towards the street. He walked down a Pool House Road where a community center and pool is down there.
So he didn't hang around the homeowner?
No, he didn't.
In the house. He left the house?
Yes, he left the house.
Any evidence of a concussion?
Now, the medical examiner said there was no evidence of a concussion, but one interesting thing the medical examiner said was that, but that's not to say one would not have developed had he lived long enough.
Okay. Prior to the criminal trial, the city reached a civil settlement with the Farrell family, agreeing to pay $2.25 million to the family. Why would that have been settled prior to the outcome of the criminal trial?
Well, I think they may have, well, generally, and Scott can correct me if I'm wrong here, but generally in a civil litigation, you've got a lower burden of proof, so to speak. And from judging from what we saw come out during the criminal trial, all these inconsistencies between what the use of force manual or policy said and what officers were being told, those discrepancies. Those would have loomed extremely large in a civil trial, and it probably would have. I think they looked at all of that, and they saw that in a civil case, they were going to be in big trouble.
Because the rules of evidence are different in a civil
case. Yeah, in a civil case, what they would have been trying to defend, they would have been defending Carrick's training and saying that the city did a good and thorough job of training him, which in the criminal trial, we saw that probably was not the case. He thought he was supposed to do one thing. Mm-hmm. The training expert from CMPD said, no, you were supposed to be doing something else. Any decent civil attorney worth his salt would have just taken that and just gone to town on it in a civil trial.
The bar is lower in civil trials. The official legal jargon, I believe, Scott, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is a preponderance of the evidence. So in a civil trial, you just have to get the needle just barely over the halfway point. And in a criminal trial, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm. It's a big difference there.
Is that the normal sequence of events, though? I mean, had this trial come out with a not guilty verdict, would the city have been better off waiting to settle the civil trial? Or is what Eric said, would that still hold true, that the weighing of the evidence would have been different and there was some question about the integrity of his training?
Hard to say. I mean, Eric's analysis is spot on. And it is, preponderance of the evidence is quite easy. It's more likely than not. But would it have made a difference in terms of the city's bargaining position if there had been a guilty verdict or not guilty verdict? Absolutely. That would change their approach strategically.
I mean, again, that seems to have come very quickly, the decision to let this civil trial go through and to plead it out for a $2.25 million settlement. That seems to have happened very quickly. Did it? Is that just my interpretation, or would that be accurate?
Well, civil trials vary considerably in length, and another factor may have been at play here. The city may have wanted to show that they were sympathetic to Mr. Farrell's position as well.
Did that in any way, could that in any way have prejudiced the jury? Was there a risk in settling a civil matter like that by the city that might have prejudiced? It didn't, but it might have prejudiced.
I think the defense feared that that was the case. That was a big concern of the defense, but it's pretty clear from the outcome that it didn't.
And it's not supposed to be brought to the jury's attention in the criminal trial either.
Randall Carrick was interviewed hours after the incident occurred, and during the trial, prosecutors pointed out inconsistencies between what he said then and how he testified in court. Among those inconsistencies was his approximate distance from Jonathan Farrell at the time of the shooting 2 years ago. He said he was 10 feet away, but during the trial, prosecutor Teresa Postel pointed out that the distance was 3 to 5 feet.
Yes, ma'am. I used the term within 10 feet. 3 to 5 feet is within 10 feet.
Do you think it would have been important if 3 to 5 feet was the truth to have told them 3 to 5 feet when they asked you to tell them what happened?
It was really hard for me to judge distance in that room that we were in, the interview room. But yes, it would be important, yes.
And actually what you did is they moved the table away and gave you as much room as you needed, and you had them step clear outside the door to show how far away it was, right?
For the whole encounter, they stepped outside the door, yes, from the time that I exited my patrol vehicle.
Fair to say that room is bigger than 3 to 5 feet?
Yes.
So how common are inconsistencies like this, especially from trained police officers?
Less so from trained police officers than ordinary witnesses, but there are always inconsistencies. The question is, how significant are those inconsistencies? What you remember 2 years ago, prior to the eve of the trial, during the trial. It's quite a period of time. And it just comes down to credibility. I mean,
the prosecutor also pressed Carrick on how he and Farrell ended up in that ditch together.
Now, you said you weren't sure if Jonathan pushed you or if he tried to grab you, but you ended up on the ground, right?
Yes, ma'am. It happened so fast. I don't know.
You backed into a really deep ditch, so you fell in the ditch, right?
I guess that's possible, but I have no idea.
Now, you told them that once you ended up on the ground, you said Jonathan started to advance up your pants leg, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you cleared that up later, still in the same portion of this statement here. In your own words, Jonathan was coming up on your lower body, right?
Yes, ma'am. His shoulders about at my waist.
If his shoulders are at your waist, then part of his body would be on your upper body, right?
I mean, I guess around where his head would be.
So I understand that's what you're saying today, but that is not what you told them on September 14th, right?
Carrick eventually admitted that was not in his original statement, and Postel also showed Carrick the uniform pants he wore that night, which had Farrell's blood on the bottom but not near the top. As I understand it, Farrell's blood or DNA was also on Officer Carrick's gun. What was the prosecution trying to convey with all this line of testimony and questioning and the evidence?
I think they were trying to show that there wasn't a real struggle, and that Officer Carrick was not really justified in continuing to shoot. But I don't think that was the crux of the trial. I think that once they got into the ditch, the jury wasn't so concerned about that. I think it was the four shots prior to that was really the crux of the case.
You also said at one point, Scott, that the DNA evidence was actually helpful to the defense. When we come back, I want to find out why you feel that way. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heartwood Tree Service. August marks 36 years of Heartwood helping Charlotte trees outlive its humans. Now caring for trees in the Asheville Black Mountain area as well. Info at heartwoodtree.com. About 60,000 American women every year are diagnosed with a kind of early stage breast cancer known as DCIS. A new study revives the debate over whether to aggressively treat it. And on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes, they'll talk about the latest on the new findings and what they mean for patients. That's at 10 o'clock this morning. If you'd like to join our conversation about the Randall Carrick trial, you can email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Oscar was a 1996 black S10 with a cap on the back.
We hauled everything in that truck.
We hauled everything.
We hauled mulch and soil and camping equipment.
Many kids moving apartment to apartment.
Truck.
It was a beautiful little truck, and it went to a beautiful cause.
My name's Pam Henry.
My name's Chris Henry, and we donated a Chevy S10 to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org, and thanks for your support.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're recapping the events surrounding the Randall Carrick trial, which ended on Friday in a mistrial. The jury deadlocked 8-4 after four votes. Gwendolyn Glenn and Duncan McFadden from WFAE News spent a considerable amount of time in the courtroom for that trial. Eric Frazier is an editorial writer with the Charlotte Observer, and Scott Broyles is a criminal law professor at the Charlotte School of Law and former assistant U.S. attorney, all of them in our Spirit Square studio this morning. You said, Scott, that the DNA evidence presented in court might actually have been helpful to the defense. Why?
Well, there's the DNA on the marijuana cigarette that you mentioned, but the more significant DNA actually brought in by the defense, not by the prosecution, which the defense made a big deal of. Why didn't you bring this in? But I think Officer Carrick's DNA under Jonathan Farrell's fingernails, but even more significantly, Jonathan Farrell's DNA on the gun and the trigger of Officer Carrick's revolver.
The prosecuting attorneys here were brought in from the state. Is that correct?
From Attorney General Roy Cooper's office. That's right.
Why?
There was a conflict of interest with the local DA's office. They had worked with the, and I think may have been partners at one time, with the defense team, some on the defense team. So they deferred to the state.
Mm-hmm. Is that unusual? Scott?
No, I understand that Andrew Murray did have a prior association, I think, with George Lauren, and the conflict that Gwendolyn referenced. Would Andrew Murray have brought the case? That's an open question. Yeah.
I actually think in theory, it's good that the local DA's office did not try this case, because you had a parade of homicide supervisors, all of whom in the normal course of their jobs deal with the district attorney's office all the time. So they're usually working together. So it would have been kind of weird.
Some have speculated that because Attorney General Roy Cooper, from whose office these prosecutors came, is probably going to give Governor McCrory a run for his money in the election in November, that perhaps there may be a political payday on this had it come out the right way. Does that have any traction in your mind?
It's a fair question.
What would the upside of it been had they gotten a guilty verdict?
Roy Cooper's a Democrat. Well, he would be the Democratic candidate for governor if he indeed does run. The African American community is a big, sort of voting bloc for the Democratic Party. It would not have hurt him, definitely, to be seen as the guy who came in and whose office brought justice for Jonathan Farrell.
We invited folks to join us on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media to ask their own questions about this. And Peggy emails, was it ever determined why Officer Carrick shot his gun 12 times? He hit Jonathan Farrell 10 times, but he shot 12 times. Duncan?
At the time, he said he thought he fired between 4 and 6 shots. He also testified that he wasn't sure that his gun was working. He was confused. And so he didn't know that he had discharged 12 bullets at the time.
If I may interject,
sure.
I've gotten a lot of heat from my own readers for saying this, but to me, those 12 shots indicated a level of just sort of panic, and I thought that's what the police department felt when they charged him. And to me, the sort of implicit in that panic was, here comes this big black guy charging at me. I don't know what to do with this. I'm going to just fire until, and I don't think it was, a conscious, in those few seconds, you don't think about all that stuff. But we know that, race and conditioning affects everybody in this society. And in moments of extreme duress or panic, you're just going to react in the way that you're conditioned to react.
And that was one of the things that the prosecution said, was that the panic kicked in and all of the training went out the window.
Scott?
Yeah, and the panic, which the argument was interesting because, again, they did not, jurors did not say race. They said this was at worst panic. But, I think it's critical to break it down. There are the four shots that occur after Officer Carrick says, stop, 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 and there's a brief pause, and then four shots fired. Then there are the subsequent shots fired after they appear, and the evidence seemed to suggest they're fighting or at least some kind of struggle occurring in the ditch. That, I think, is all the shots in the revolver at that point make sense. Those first four shots, I think, are the interesting question.
And were both of the other officers unable to see what was going on in the ditch? I think one of you said one said that he couldn't see what was going on. Did both of them not see?
Well, I know Officer Neal said he didn't see the first four, but he said then he saw them in the ditch, and he said that that's when he saw Jonathan Farrell around the ankles and the feet and the shins of Officer Carrick, and that he was kind of looked like he was pulling up, and then he stopped. And he said, and that's when there was a pause, and then Jonathan Farrell, he said, started to move again, and that's when the other shots were fired.
One of the last things that defense attorneys asked Carrick was, is there anything he believed that he could have done differently? And Carrick answered no and then explained.
When we encountered the suspect, he charged towards Officer Little. Officer Little deployed his taser. At the time, I thought the taser had hit the suspect, and it just didn't stop him. As he charged towards me, he got within arm's reach, and I discharged my firearm. I didn't know if he had a weapon in his hands at that time. I didn't know if he had a weapon anywhere on him at all. And then he had a good chance to get my gun from me and take it from me.
Was Carrick's testimony helpful to the defense, and how big a risk was it to put him on the stand in the first place?
I think you have to put Officer Carrick on the stand here when credibility is so at issue. Again, we don't know what happened once Mr. Farrell turned off. And if he had not gone up, you can talk about the Fifth Amendment right not to take the stand all you want. The jury would have looked very suspiciously on Officer Carrick had he not defended his story and given his account.
Yeah, and I think the fact that he was, you know, he didn't, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but he didn't explicitly say, I'm sorry for what happened from the witness stand. But all those tears and that emotion, that, you know, I think that built a pretty big reservoir of sympathy for him with the jurors.
And it was consistent with his statement right after the shooting, right, when he was visibly upset, mm-hmm, as well.
He didn't say it, but I don't think he was asked it either. Just to be clear, yeah, he was testifying. You can only answer the questions you're asked. So, but there was an implied sense of, mm-hmm, remorse, mm-hmm, with the emotion he showed. Mm-hmm.
During the trial, I think 50 of something like 200 witnesses were called to testify. I know, Scott, you found that pretty interesting. Why?
Well, I don't know if I found it interesting. I do think that but what I did find interesting was that the defense almost acted as the prosecution because they were bringing in so much evidence trying to establish their account of it was a longer story. It was not just the shooting, but it was an erratic, aggressive man by showing the earlier drinking and smoking and car accident at the banging on the house, erratic, aggressive behavior that continued over and spilled into the events that led to the actual shooting. The prosecution did not want to really focus on that.
So you say the defense acted like the prosecution because the prosecution, in the closing arguments at least, usually lays out all the facts again,
exactly,
as methodically as possible, and they didn't do that. The defense did.
Yeah, I think the prosecution really miscalculated badly in this case. They just thought that – I think they were going from the standpoint of here are the elements of the charge. We feel like we have the facts of this case fit the elements of the charge. That's why we brought the charge. So we'll just tell you the basic facts. We think they fit the facts, or they fit the charge, and therefore you will, you know, find him guilty. And the defense was able to just sort of, you know, add all these other factors, and the prosecution just seemed to think that, but still, there's the fact, here's the charge, mm-hmm, here's the elements, we gave you the elements, you should find, and that's not the way human nature works.
During
it's not that simple.
During the closing arguments, Prosecutor Arden Harris argued that Randall Carrick had a litany of non-lethal options at his disposal, but that he abandoned his training and fired those shots even though he had time to switch to non-lethal force.
Defendant, ladies and gentlemen, had enough time. Time Jonathan begins running to the first shots of fire. tumultuous way. He had enough time to holster that weapon and transition to his taser, his baton, his spray.
In his closing arguments, defense attorney George Lauren countered it this way.
4 seconds. Does that make sense for this officer to reholster his firearm and go hands-on with somebody who has blown through a taser, who is obviously the suspect in a crime of violence, a breaking and entering felon charge, burglary, occupied by somebody, who has failed to heed commands, who's failed to stop? Does it make sense for an officer to reholster his firearm and say, hey, buddy, let's fight?
That's what the jury had to grapple with in the jury room. Yeah.
The reholstering argument was very weak, I thought, from the prosecution. And I think they were kind of boxed in by the inconsistencies in the training. They couldn't say that he should have never pulled his gun, which I'm sure that's what that would have been a much stronger argument. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't say that because they were able to say that a training supervisor had told him he should pull a gun in that kind of situation.
Well, one thing they said that he could have pulled the gun, but he was not trained to fire it. That was okay. And when you talked about those, and when Lauren talked about how quickly everything happened, one thing they also brought out, one of the trainers, was that the guns that CMPD police use, you can hit something and the magazine drops out. And said, and even if he thought Jonathan Farrell was going for his gun, he could have done that. The magazine drops out. The gun is useless.
Any explanation as to why one officer pulled a taser, another officer pulled the gun? You've already said, I think, Eric, that he pulled the gun because he was told that if an officer pulls a taser, you back him up with lethal force.
Sure.
The third officer pulled nothing. Mm-hmm. Any explanation as to why?
Well, the third officer testified that he felt like he was just going to have to fight him. And I think that those discrepancies between those three officers, it speaks to a lot of the questions that people in the African-American community have about if I, as an African-American man, encounter a police officer in a tense situation, there is the thought and the presumption and the feeling among people in the African-American community that if that officer is black, I have a better chance of escaping that situation unharmed, that tense situation. If that officer is white, there's a chance he may be scared for no good reason if you're not intending any harm, but that officer in that instant does not have any way to know that for sure. There is that feeling. And, so that is a question that was, raised in this case, and it kind of still lingers out there. I think the question that the one African-American male juror asked, that he said he put on the board, what did Jonathan Farrell do to deserve to die? In the black community, that question still stands.
Well, our new police chief, the police chief who brought charges, Rodney Monroe, was African-American. Our new police chief, Kirk Putney, is African-American. And although he didn't bring the charges, he was asked after the trial if he had any regrets.
Do I have any regrets? No. I think we have a professional force that's very competent that have mastered the area of criminal investigations. I think they did a very good job, and I think our charges were appropriate. We again defer to the jury. The decision's been made, or the inability to come to a firm decision. So we'll see what happens moving forward as the justice system runs its course.
And I guess he was also asked to defend the training of a police officer at CMPD because there was some confusion over the sequence of events that Randall Carrick faced in the heat of the incident. Should he have pulled a gun? Should he have fired the gun?
And our training is consistent. You can draw your weapon in anticipation if you suspect somebody might be armed, but you cannot shoot until you're actually encountering a lethal threat, meaning the person's armed and about to do you harm.
So what does this decision, this hung jury, this lack of decision, say to the African-American community? Because Ed on Facebook, who does not identify himself in any way as to his race, says no surprise, no justice, no peace. So that's certainly an opinion that's floating around out there.
Well, I think it says that there's still a pretty big divide in terms of how, I won't say every black person and every white person, because there are, you know, individual people have differences. But there is it does remind the black community that the way that, by and large, black people tend to see this type of thing differs from the way, by and large, white people tend to see this type of thing. And I think it boils down to perceptions of black men. You had two black officers who, you know, saw this guy as, there's something wrong with this guy. He could be a threat, mm-hmm. but we can probably handle him. And you had a third officer, a white officer, who saw this guy as, he's going to take my gun and probably kill me.
And yet, and yet the white officer was confronting this alleged assailant, mm-hmm. African-American man, but he had two African-American police officers backing him up. And Jolene on Facebook says, what were the other officers doing when Kerrick was firing and wrestling with Farrell? Did he not think they would come to his aid? Did he not have confidence in his fellow officers?
Well, it all happened so fast, though. Right. It was just a matter of seconds.
And remember, Officer Little, the African-American who supported, by and large, Officer Kerrick's actions, he fired a taser at him, and he described Jonathan Farrell as bull-rushing. And it was Officer Kerrick who was bull-rushed, if that's the correct term.
So where do we go from here? We only have 15 seconds. If there's no trial, can he be reinstated as a police officer, and is that likely to happen?
Go ahead, Eric.
I would think it's unlikely, given that it's the department, you know, the department brought the charges and felt that he had done wrong. So you would think that there's some discipline that
you
would follow.
You will get the last word. Eric Fraser from the Charlotte Observer, Scott Broyles from the Charlotte School of Law, and Gwendolyn Glenn and Duncan McFadden, both reporters who covered the trial for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.